I'd like to give a talk called Transparency. Rumi speaks about his teacher. And when he speaks about his teacher, sometimes it sounds like he's speaking about the human soul or the free human being and not just his one teacher, but all of our possibility, all of our potential. And one little line from the Forbidden Rumi, so there's this last book of Rumi's poems that was only translated more recently because the government considered it heretical. Was too juicy and too heretical. So the funding for that translation of that book didn't happen with the other books. And Rumi says that there's so much kindness in the person of his teacher that everyone comes knocking at his door. And as soon as they're let in, they're forgiven. And that's one definition of meditation. So this talk is also continuing to answer Pam's question about what is meditation in different ways. So one is that there's so much kindness that everything comes knocking, and as the door opens, everything is forgiven. So what is forgiveness? Forgiveness is something that I consider us unable to do on purpose. And so there's that saying in English, to err is human, to forgive divine. So feeling into forgiveness as something divine that happens. So that first means we start with to err is human, which is already a very forgiving statement. To know and accept, to acknowledge that we make errors. Human beings make errors. We could say every day. If that's already acknowledged, so there's already some kind of forgiveness happening. We've already entered the divine realm just to acknowledge that we will make mistakes. We've already, what does that mean to enter the divine realm, to be in on the part of the divine? We've come into maybe big mind, we've come into a wider place or perspective where there's more possibilities. Something that the human being can't do or make. We can do and make mistakes, and we can't do or make forgiveness. But accepting that, we've already got one foot in divinity. We've already got some forgiveness happening. We've already come to something that we can't make. So I don't know about you, but if you've ever tried to make yourself forgive, I wonder how it went. Sometimes we would lead in the beginning of a loving kindness meditation, a forgiveness practice that's to clear some space so that there could then be a little bit more room for uncovering the natural friendliness. And so it's trying to find somewhere that there would be an intention, already an intention that could wish to forgive. But what I found is what's more honest for most of us is there's somewhere that wishes for peace, very, very honestly, wishes for peace. And that can start to lead towards a happening of forgiveness. What forgiveness is that whatever wound might have happened, whether I have hurt myself and there's not yet forgiveness for myself and then there is, or whether someone else has hurt me or I've hurt someone else and there's a wound, there's an effect from that hurt, from that mistake. And then at some point there isn't that wound anymore. So there's a process where there's a wound and then there's healing of the wound. And then there starts to be absence of wound. But we could still feel the absence of wound. And sometimes if the absence of wound, if we remember, then the wound comes back. And so forgiveness is when there's not even absence of wound anymore. So one of my teachers talks about this in translating a Sanskrit text, the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. He talks about, he calls them dry lines. So his example, his metaphor is, if you remember sometime that there were water spilled on a table, and then it dried, so we didn't wipe it down, it dried. And so at some angle, you can see the outline of the shape of the water. And if you would spill water again there, the water would tend to take the same shape, unless it's a lot more water. It would tend to find that same shape and fill it out. So sometimes our wound has dried, but this kind of scar is still there. And it's not really in our hands, within our willpower, to wipe that away. But it can happen through practice, through allowing that acknowledgement that mistakes happen as a beginning of forgiveness. I make mistakes, you make mistakes, we all make mistakes. That's human. And that something that's divine, to err, to forgive is divine. There's something that is divine that can sometimes happen. When certain forces and factors come into play at the right time, in the right place. We explored today in the meditation instructions, feeling the texture of ignoring. And sometimes we could feel the texture of ignoring. We notice what it feels like to notice I'm avoiding something or escaping something or blinding to something. And in the process of trying to explore the texture of ignoring, some of you came across the texture of hating or the texture of being against. So that would be where the wound is more active. But when there's just ignoring, that would be when the wound is more dried. But there's still a non-feeling. And when the feeling can come into what we ignore, when we come into what we've turned away from, what's against the rules, the shadow, etc., it gives more chance for that accident of forgiveness, that divine accident, to happen. The wiping away of the seeds. So in the yoga tradition, they talk about meditation in a very particular way. Actually, they give several different options, but one interesting description of meditation is going through samadhis. So samadhi is, sham is like, if you've heard of shamatha, so calmness or being gathered, having a steadiness, having concentration. Or we could take it as having no compulsion to be either active or passive. So sham with dhi, which is light. So when there's not that compassion, that compulsion to be active or passive. So in many situations, we would have a compulsion to be more active or more passive. That's easy to find. It's easy to find where Pam is almost compelled out of the room in response to the sound, the repetitive sound. Others of us are compelled into a kind of ignoring as the sound goes on longer and longer. So we're compelled into ignoring it. We're compelled into passivity. It's not a fresh response, it's a compulsion, compelled response. When that compulsion gets more flexible and fluid and less dominant, then we start to be more in touch with dhi, which we could say is a kind of natural light of wisdom. a natural light of clarity, a natural light of what I quoted Emerson as talking about in the, I think, the first evening of the retreat. When we're in touch with the commonwealth, we're in touch with something that's not my personal interest and agenda, but something that's for, we're a wind that is blowing for the good of all. We let our sail be set to that. So it's kind of easy to feel how that would be when I'm less compelled to be active because of habit or conditioning, or passive because of conditioning. I'm more flexible to start to be lifted by the wind of, let's say, in the saying, thy will, not my will be done, for example, thy will. So set to the wind of some kind of movement that could guide in a way, guide our movements, our responsiveness in a way that's for the benefit of all and not my personal story. So that's samadhi. coming into a kind of peace with things, so there's less reactiveness, but that allows us to be responsive from another place. And so there's a samadhi where we kind of practice and train and put ourselves in there for a certain amount of time, and then when the time's up, we come out. And then we practice that for a while, longer, 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 and then we fall into samadhi in a way that is timeless and therefore seems to have the power to wipe away the dry lines. It seems to have the power for that deep forgiveness. I'm using the word forgiveness in a different way. A forgiveness, so in the sense of wiping away the conditioning, wiping away any kind of pre-shaping of how things should go. Then comes Sahaj Samadhi. Then when we've kind of cooked all the seeds so they can't sprout, all the dry lines are wiped away, forgiveness has happened. So much kindness has filled the being, everything has come to the door and been forgiven. So there's not any personal story trying to find an ending. There's a different kind of rightness, a different kind of goodness, a different kind of pleasure, a different kind of appropriateness that has non-intentionality as its kind of flag. So before, all the vehicles we could get into had a flag, like a country flag. Mm-hmm. It was with a certain constitution, a certain bill of rights, a certain government. This is a kind of vehicle which, in the Yog Vashisht, it's a vehicle that can go on any medium. It can go on water, on land, through the earth, through the air. Any medium. It doesn't need a road or a track or water. It can go through any way. And it has the flag of non-intentionality. And so it leaves room for what we call now synchronicity. We might have a different word for it as we get more used to the fact of it. But I'd like to talk a little bit more first about the dry lines, or those kinds of intentions or rules that tend to guide our behavior or compel us to act in certain ways. There's a really helpful list that Brené Brown, is that her name? Brené Brown? Sociologist? Yeah? Thank you. Has come up with by looking at different research on us people. And in the first world cultures, what is considered feminine and what is considered masculine, and what that would leave us with. So Feminine is, of course, thin as the first priority, and then nice, and then modest. So if we're trying to be authentic women, then we would be trying to say our truth without hurting anyone's feelings or disagreeing with anyone, or without admitting that we might have come up with something ourselves and without taking up too much space. The men also don't have a very good chance if they follow the rules. So the qualities that are culturally considered to be masculine or male are control of emotion, primacy of work, control over women, and the pursuit of status. So a man who might feel some real wish to be in intimacy doesn't have much of a chance if he's going to try to follow the rules. Doesn't have much chance for a whole life. So feeling the ways that we, even if we disagree with that stereotype or that model of our gender, if we identify with a gender, somewhere inside we might be in disagreement with and therefore reacting to. So I'm not going to be thin, I'm not going to be nice, I'm not going to be modest, or I'm not going to go for work, I'm not going to control women, I'm not going to, well, maybe the control women we can disagree with actively. No, but if we're in reaction to the rule, we're somehow still obeying the rule, of course. And so there's not the freedom. There might not be the freedom for the new age man to sometimes interrupt a woman, because that goes against the rules of the anti-male stereotype. So it can be fun to feel and discover ways of feeling these kind of rules acting, and how when we're accidentally going against the rule, there can be a kind of shame, which is Brené Brown's point. There's a kind of shame that even if I really want to live an authentic life and ignore the rules, when I do find myself accidentally going against them, or I'm trying to go against them and I accidentally go with them, the kind of shame that comes and weighs us down and doesn't let us go sailing in that divine wind. Someone named, and I'm not sure if I will be pronouncing it anywhere near correctly, Albert Zangyorgi, said a discovery is said to be an accident meeting a prepared mind. A discovery is an accident. It's said to be an accident. We can say a discovery is an accident meeting a prepared mind. So there is the preparation in the spiritual practice, in meditation, that helps the mind be more malleable, is one of the words in the Buddhist texts. So it's less obedient to the rules, it's more malleable, it's more responsive to life, to aliveness, to what isn't programmed, pre-programmed. A prepared mind is more receptive, more responsive, less pre-programmed, and so therefore more likely to meet the accident of discovery. Discovery, an accident meeting a prepared mind. So part of the preparation that we've mentioned today several times is that opening to what's happening so that we could also notice what's being ignored, and just noticing the ignoring, opening to include that. Ignoring can take so many different forms, including like a busy mind is a form of ignoring the rest of life. Getting the feeling for ignoring will help us come into a natural receptivity that's wider and wider. And so that's one way of preparing the mind so that accident of discovery can meet it. There's also the really lovely, commonly told little joke about enlightenment, that enlightenment is like, let's say, for example, a breeze, but you need to open the window so the breeze can come in. You can't make the breeze happen, but you can at least open the window so that the breeze can come in. Enlightenment is an accident waiting to happen, how to be more accident prone. Mm-hmm. So this preparation of the mind. Curiously enough, we don't have to do that much. We don't have to be like scrubbing at all the dried lines, really. It's more noticing that pre-programming, getting the feeling of how it's less sensitive than when there's not programming. It's less receptive. There's that calloused or cataract feeling that we're exploring today. Noticing that already invites aliveness to come in and do what it needs to do. So it allows the divine or the breeze to come in and do what only it can do. Allow forces by accident to happen as discovery or as enlightenment. Another way to talk about this preparation, so our part of the game, is really feeling into, in the way that I mentioned in my last talk two afternoons ago, when I talked about giving treatments and having the chance, it's like having permission because of that form of giving a treatment, we're both quiet together, to feel the softness in each of us behind everything else, to actually feel through the everything else into the softness of each other. So, transparency. Allowing the defenses and pretensions and so on to be transparent, how easy it is actually to feel each other, the softness behind the show, the fear, the wish for recognition, etc. And the image that has come to me today is, it's a funny image. I hope I can bring it across. The feeling is that in us, it's as if we have this kind of structure of our personality. So the part that wants recognition to come into the machine so that the machine will work and we can function in life, we can get through life. This is the way we've been told to survive. So we have this kind of machine-like, hard, constructed structure sitting on top of this completely soft, like a sea jelly or something, that's sort of pink and glowing, but completely soft. It doesn't seem to be bothered at all by that hard structure that has been made. I can't really say we've made the personality. It has been made. It is hard. It has its hardness. It has been made, so it can come unmade. And luckily, the sort of sea jelly doesn't seem to mind. It doesn't seem to be uncomfortable, even if it sounds like it would be. And feeling into our sea jellies, it's feeling into a place that is non-verbal. And so I think one thing that happens is we've been taught that verbal is how you get through life and get quick results and get what you need to get. So the survival mode is tied to being verbal, and being pre-verbal is being helpless and powerless and dumb. And we have that one word in English for stupid and mute. And so sometimes I think we don't trust that sea jelly could be smart enough to get us through life, because it's dumb. It has no words. And there's an assumption somehow through fear and without any real experimentation with the sea jelly. We assume without testing that it couldn't handle life. It couldn't deal with the hard world, the real world. Because it must be so primitive, since it can't speak. It can't think. It doesn't bother with thinking or words. Words and thinking can't quite go there either. And so we stay with the values of that hard structure, which is not really only personality, it's also a kind of collective and cultural structure. the best way to talk about the structure, that little house that we tend to live in on top of ourselves, who we think we are, that's been made. So it's been made partly through personal events and partly through the culture, partly through history. But we stay within the house according to the accounts of the house and the calculations of the house and the values of the house. In the values of the house, words are important, thinking is important. And so if we can't think about that place, and if we can't speak about that place, that sea jelly down there, so pink and boneless and skinless, translucent, it can't be sophisticated enough to handle this world that I can't quite manage myself. But it would be worth making the experiment when we notice that we can't quite handle it ourselves. The little house doesn't do it very well. It's always sort of falling off that sea jelly and never seems to quite fit us. It's always a little tight and hard and unstable, dark. So practicing coming out of the house and playing with, is it possible to live from the sea jelly, from the translucence, without bones, without skin, and letting the sea jelly inform later on the thinking and the words. So in some situations where we might have stage fright and we might need to speak, we might want to prepare something. But other times we might more, if we're in a conversation, so tomorrow when silence ends, for example, we might play with, what if I, instead of coming with my words first, I come with the sea jelly first and just check if any words come from the sea jelly before I come from the house. Just what, is there any word worth saying right now or not? And if so, does it come from the translucence? When we take time to experiment, we notice that we've hardly ever experimented this way. So we think it's impossible, but we haven't tried. When we realize that and we notice that the way we keep trying over and over again doesn't work, at least not so well, it's not a big enough life. It keeps going with the wrong winds, doesn't find that big wind. It keeps on making mistakes, but doesn't find forgiveness happening. We might find that experiences that come out with experimenting, with coming from that soft translucence, end up being much more sophisticated and having better words in the end than how we would have done it ourselves, who we think we are. The chance that, since it's not working as it is, what if we could actually live from that place of softness and non-intentionality? And it's a softness it's so soft that it has all the power in the world. And so it can go with either masculine or feminine. It can be active or passive. It can interrupt, as well as not be in a hurry to say what needs to be said until it's actually the moment that it's called forth, those words are called forth. Suzuki Roshi said, big mind is always on your side. And that can be something that starts to help us at least make an experiment or two every day of coming to that sea jelly out of who we think we are, who can't handle it anyway. So it's a lot about trust and also hopelessness, knowing that all the strategies we've worked with have failed. They failed. And instead of trying to find the right strategy, what if we have not a strategy? What if we have that minority of one, that living in a world full of strategies, not blinding ourselves to strategy going on, we can feel it more and more clearly as we come out of our own little house of strategy. And trusting something to happen, an accident to happen, a discovery to happen, an insight to happen. Something other than mistake, something other than just human to happen through the human. So before we go on to a couple of themes of what seems to happen when we make room for accidents, to talk first about that little house, the who we think we are, which is partly personality and partly cultural conditioning and even the biological house that's smaller than what we really are, or all that we are. The compelled person. Talking about two things, talking about a house as who we think we are, and then something else that might be able to come out with, might be able to let through more sophisticated, more big wind, big mind, movements, responses, responsiveness, could make us easily in a tug of war in our mind, in our understanding of ourselves, between the small and the big, the hard and the soft, etc. But from the big mind, always on your side, it's not against anything. From the translucent sea jelly, there's no problem with that hardness. It doesn't hurt the sea jelly that it's hard. It hurts the house that it's hard. And there's a story that is a true story that happened in a school that I like as an example and a metaphor for helping us come out of that tendency to go towards making tug of war, making dualism in a way that's not true or accurate to the bigger picture. In the school, there was a boy, a student, who was mean to everyone and always getting in trouble and making problems. And it got to the point where the staff and the students and the whole body of the school realized something had to be done. It couldn't go on this way. So that's when we realized we can't live in the house anymore. Something must be done. And so the normal logic would be, what kind of punishment would sort of coerce this boy into repressing his aggression, or maybe at best sort of having a realization that his actions cause harm to others, it hurts them. And so maybe he can feel for others and start to pull his energy back in somehow. But in this case, there was one teacher in the school who had done some work with this family constellations that I mentioned the other day, an interesting way of working with the psyche. And that made her open to feeling how maybe this boy was kind of playing a role that was somehow related to everyone else in the school. It wasn't just his problem affecting everyone else, but somehow everyone's problem. He was bringing out everyone's problem. In a family constellation, just where we stand in relation to the others brings about a certain experience and a certain dynamic. So it's a way that we might be compelled to feel, experience, and behave certain things. We might so easily be taken over by that position, by that role. And so this one woman, this teacher, offered the idea, which was accepted, which is also amazing, that they do a different kind of experiment rather than punishing the boy or giving him such an intense experience that he would somehow come to a breaking point and realize the power of his actions. And so they did call the boy in front of the whole body of the school, so everyone was present. And the way I understand it, the boy was in front of everyone, and then each person in the whole body of the school went to the boy in front of everyone else and said, "You belong." So one by one. Always touches me when I tell the story. Such a revolution of approach. Taking responsibility on all of us instead of blaming and excluding. So that would be one approach to the hardness in us, to the personality in us, to the compulsions, to the thinking mind, to the conditioned heart. That's preparation for a discovery, for an accident, for accident of forgiveness, accident of sahaj. If we could just feel how that quality would be, that every single person, you belong, you belong, you belong. Every part of us agreeing, you belong, to even the most difficult aspects of us. So that discipline. With that rigor. And then to touch more on the sea jelly, which also it would be good to remind ourselves, you belong. It's something that exists. It's not our imagination. But we can easily feel when we're in the house that it's just our imagination, or it was just a past experience. And there's a story from the life of Krishna that talks about the sea jelly. That juiciness without sort of borders, without proper skin covering it up, covering the inside. So Krishna, it's said that he was a real person, as well as now being revered as a god. So we could also talk about meditation as a process where we allow human to include the divine, to be divine. We bring divinity to earth, to a body. And so there's that tradition in India of incarnation. They talk about the incarnation of God. So Krishna is said to be an incarnation of God. And we could take it as that is our potential, to be incarnation of. So not just human, but incarnation of. the limitless. So Krishna was said to be, as actually Jess mentioned yesterday, as a child, so naughty and so just exulting in the naughtiness of stealing all the butter of his own pantry and of the neighbors as well. But so happily that there was not a sense of wrongness. And also, he was said to have many girlfriends as a young boy, as actually young teenager. So 13, 14, 15. And first of all, if we could just pause and imagine a culture where kids who were kind of on that verge of sexuality, the flowering of sexuality, instead of being left sort of confused and in pain and not knowing, even with all the biology classes, what's actually happening and what to do with all that energy. But the possibility that if Krishna had many girlfriends, then a lot of girlfriends had Krishna. And that the Radha, his main sort of lover, was at the peak of the stories, was 14. So there's the Indian culture now, which is nearly a war on women, like all around the world. At that time, a 14-year-old girl was having an unproblematic sexuality with a guy who was also a cowherd, like she sort of village life. But anyway, this one story can trigger some of our buttons in today's culture. There's a story of, in the night, what they called the Ras Lila. So Ras is juice, and Lila could be called play. I wish Peter were here to ask the Hindi, the derivation in Hindi. Do you happen to know for Lila? And the pictures of it now, which you find, the way you find in the pilgrimage places, also in the first world, these kind of really kitsch posters that you can find. And it has a certain charm. And the pictures are of a Krishna with each of his girlfriends in the night dancing, twirling. And it's meant to be a metaphor for our own energy systems, all of the different energy centers twirling freely, so not compelled, not with dry lines, not trying to dominate or trying to be dominated or whatever, just freely twirling. And in the story level of the story, there's each girl, young woman, with her lover dancing in the night and enjoying it. So ras, there's the juice, and there's the play. So this is when we come into contact with that jelly, that so softness and that other kind of goodness, lightness, brightness, insight, a flame that we would just, it's not a vigil like that we keep, but that keeps us. We would just lay our head by that flame happening and be entranced by that flame happening. And then as soon as we think, oh, maybe that's my sea jelly, or that's really good, or as soon as that movement happens, we can't feel it anymore. And so as soon as we go back to the house to write it down, I found my sea jelly, we've lost touch with it, necessarily. So in the story, as soon as the girl or the young woman, as you like, thinks, ah, he's all mine, I have him tonight, he's gone. So she's dancing with him, and she can feel him, her beloved, who loves her. And in that contact, there's a twirling, a whirling, a free-flowing, a big wind, a divine on the earth, in the body. Things are where they belong. And then as soon as she says, I've got him, like, as if now I've seduced him just for me. that he would need to be just for me to have him, that I would need to define him for it to be true, for it to be real, for me to count on it. As soon as that movement happens, we know, we can't, we close the hand and there's no space for it anymore. But as soon as we open the hand again, we can feel it again. Sometimes. So that's just kind of information about why we get confused about the sea jelly, about why we get confused about the softness, and then we can call it unreliable and not sophisticated enough to deal with the real world. But it's our own sophistication that's stopping us from staying in continual contact, in continual resting with that inspiration. So, rather briefly, two qualities or things that seem to happen when we let sea jelly run the show, when we let us be that also. And from that softness that's so soft and without skin, without barrier, without limit, that there is room for everything, and even the hardness falls into place. And there is that utter willingness to be lifted with that wind that knows better than we do. It has a wider view than in the house we have. So one quality is gentleness, which we've talked about frequently. But just to state that, as we know, as we notice in our experience, gentleness doesn't always behave according to our image of gentleness. So gentleness sometimes spreads into such a pleasure that something unpleasant is allowed to be felt. And so this is that question of, is it really an upper limits problem when I'm so open and happy and in bliss that necessarily something painful will come next as a necessary next step? Is it an upper limits problem that I think I can't take that much goodness, or is it that that much goodness is that kindness that invites everything to the door so that it can be forgiven, so that it can be cleared, so that it can be loved into transparency, so that it can be loved into transparency so that it's not taking up space, it's not dense, and it's not directing the show, it's not in the way, it's not problematic. And sometimes gentleness allows us to have an accidental shift of perspective that allows an accidental shift in behavior. And sometimes that behavior doesn't look gentle. That's simply enough said. But I want to say more specifically, when we are in a flow of gentleness, we allow gentleness to keep flowing. So it's not a static state. We allow gentleness to keep arriving and flowing through. And we're coming back to that non-intentionality again. Sometimes we're so entranced with the gentleness, we're so involved in that dance, allowing the movement to happen, that only later we realize that something courageous happened. There has been a breakthrough, or there has been an insight. There has been an absolute change, not a relative change. And this is practice. This is what practice is, or this is a fruit of practice. So when we're in the house trying to steer our little houseboat on this slippery thing, whatever it is, we don't want to deal with whatever it might be because it doesn't have any skin and it grosses me out, the sea jelly. We want to know, what am I practicing, and in what direction, for what reason, for what result? With whom? In what lineage? And where is it focused now? What is it working on now? And I would suggest that many times we do need to know something of what we're practicing, very gently, though, so that it leaves space for a lot more. And that mostly we're going to find out 10 years from now what we just practiced, what results were achieved. And we may find that out from other people because it's been wiped away. There's not even the absence of that anymore to trace back. So it could be that we're here again in 10 years and I can remind you, oh yes, remember you told me that such and such a thing. You were pushy, or you were a thinker, or you were afraid, or whatever. So not sticking to the definition, the dry waterline or whatever, of what we think gentleness is when we're practicing gentleness, preparing the mind with gentleness, allowing gentleness to keep preparing the mind, softening the mind so that it feels that it does belong with the sea jelly. The sea jelly can help it find its place. And then I've just given an example of synchronicity and an example of non-intentionality. So by loving what we love, so enjoying the gentleness and how it can fill the mind and how then it invites everything to come and forgives whatever comes in the door, which is a radical action without any hard edge. So radical, like in the sense of rooting out, like deeply finished with the compulsion. In a way that I couldn't if I tried. So to err is human, to forgive is divine. We make room for us to participate in divine will or divine action. So something beyond our imagining that happens in and through a whole human being. Non-intentionality or synchronicity also gives each other and ourselves a lot of freedom and room to behave outside of the personality, outside of the house. And at the same time that it allows a deep appreciation for what people give, it also allows a deep appreciation and a wide appreciation for what happens partly because of what other people and what we ourselves do, and partly how those accidents happen through the prepared mind. So we can be grateful to each other's prepared minds that allow accidents to happen, that can sometimes seem to be someone did something, but it might not be. So by chance, someone felt, they don't know why, to pick a flower, even though they don't pick flowers. That's against their rule, but that big wind picked a flower with their hand. And then their hand didn't mean to, but it handed it to you. And you felt that wind with the flower. So it's not just the personal gesture which happened and has a certain meaning, but it's also a vehicle for the big wind to come in and let me feel its softness to remind me of the softness inside me. And instead of saying, oh, you really saved my day by giving me the flower, that how did you know? Maybe at best the person didn't know. They weren't trying to get an effect. They were kind of obeying. Kindness picked a flower, which is an unkind act if you think, like strictly speaking. And then giving a dead creature to another person could be taken as, I'm not going to touch that bloody thing. Or it could be taken as a reminder of love. But when it happens in that really free-flowing way, accidental way, the big wind can be felt more easily with the gesture. The gesture is needed as a reminder or as an incarnation of the big wind. But it's not just about the gesture. And so noticing when we start to close down the story of like so-and-so did such and such a thing that had such and such a result. Knowing that, so going to not knowing, knowing that we not know how and why, but allowing the big wind to come in and to go forth. A way that this can come about, this synchronicity, that we can be open to, we can recognize the quality of synchronicity and not close it down into a personal story, but let it be personal and bigger. That person followed through on something that allowed the big wind to move both of us. Where we could move into a place where we could feel what's ungraspable that speaks of our not separateness. So it's one strange little example that I want to bring out. It keeps coming to mind, so I bring out. And it's about cracking the night open. So the Ras Lila dance happened at night. And sometimes you might have noticed when you're resting a lot, wakefulness at night happens, whether before going to sleep or after sleeping or in the middle. And we would usually take that as a bad sign. Oh my God, what am I going to do? On a rest retreat, we had the chance to say, oh, well, at least I won't miss much. I don't have so much to do tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could clean the bathroom later on if I sleep through breakfast. But sometimes that taking that as just a happening, that there's wakefulness at night, and it's kind of befriending the night again, bringing the night back into the human and divine realm, a place where human and divine meet in a very particular way, which can sometimes be, because of the stillness, incredibly and especially intense, and sometimes because of the stillness, it can be especially and incredibly soothing. And sometimes both, because of that soothing and the stillness, the clarity of the deeper flame or insight can be astonishing, can come through more easily, even if it's just a kind of a whisper. And so leaving room for, if you happen to be awake at night, it's not so much about, right, I'm going to wake myself up at 2 o'clock, which is the time that someone told me they wake up for their practice. But we could prepare for nighttime by resting in the day so that there is, the night can break open with its juice and we can drink it. And it has a way of kind of breaking through that seeming bedrock of anxiety that can take over while we're deep asleep and while we're sleepwalking through our day. It can just break through that seeming bedrock of anxiety and bring us to a greater depth. That radical non-intentionality. And what starts to happen as we let everything belong and let ourselves be in contact with what we can't grasp. And because we can't grasp it, it has a certain resilience, a certain, because it's untouchable, unshakable, it has a certain, in its vulnerability, invulnerability. It's beyond the reach of anything that could break it. What seems to happen from there is dark and light together, night and day, working together. What we don't like and what we like, working together. Active and passive, working together. Stillness and whirling, working together. Incarnation and divine, working together. Error and forgiveness, working together. And that allows, in a lovely phrase of Krishnamurti, that allows what he called meditation is the movement of love from innocence to innocence. So we come into a kind of innocence that's like that forgiveness of the errors already before they happen and also after they happen. Two different kinds of forgiveness. And the innocence that there's not something fundamentally, radically problematic or wrong that doesn't belong here. And innocence in that not knowing and accepting not knowing, the impossibility of knowing, but the possibility of being moved, of love moving from innocence to innocence. From a wholeness of us to a wholeness of us, where there's no longer really a shadow. In the wholeness of us, no longer really separation. What seemed to block the view, what is translucent, can feel and see through. And what seemed beyond the human has our human eyes to see through, to be incarnation. Nothing to hide, transparency, and nothing that could block the view of love. May we know our transparency, may we live and love and give our transparency. In this world, as a transparency, a world that is transparent to love.